Welcome to the show that gets Christians thinking about faith and politics. Get ready to challenge the status quo, expand your imagination, and tackle controversy head on. Let's stand together at the intersection of faith and freedom. It's time for the Libertarian Christian Podcast.
Greetings, I'm Cody Cook, and you're listening to the Libertarian Christian Podcast, a project of the Christians for Liberty Network. My guest today is Caleb S. Fuller, and the S is important, I think, because if you're an important author or thinker, you just go by the middle initial, but if you're like a serial killer or something, you put the middle name in, right? So the S is good, that's a good sign. So Caleb Fuller is an associate professor of economics at Grove City College. He's a research fellow at the Independent Institute. And he's the author of two books on economics, at least two that I was able to find, No Free Lunch and Mere Economics. And the latter is his most recent book. It's a fantastic introduction to economics, especially from a Christian values point of view. And I'm very pleased to introduce him to you, dear listener. Caleb, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you for having me. The pleasure is all mine. I'm certainly thrilled to be talking about economics with you this morning.
I'm always thrilled to be talking about economics. Okay, so why did you call the book Mere Economics?
Yeah. Think of my most recent book, which is co-authored with Art Carden, I should mention. This is a collaborative project with him. Think of this book as a mashup of Thomas Sowell's Basic Economics or Henry Hazlitt's Economics in One Lesson with C.S. Lewis's Mere Christianity. Now, maybe the jury's still out on whether it was wise for Art and myself to invite comparisons of our prose to a master of the English language like C.S. Lewis, but our aim was very similar to his aim in Mere Christianity. We wanted to communicate the basic lowercase o orthodox consensus principles of economics in a way that would be both clear and memorable. And we also wanted to frame our economics in light of foundational Christian doctrines about creation and about man. So both our economics and our theology in this book strive to be genuinely mere in the Lewisian sense. Now, I think sometimes when people hear that framing about the book, a common question, and I understand the question that they have, is something like, hold on a second, you're telling me that economists actually agree about things. And the actual answer to that question is that yes, we do agree on a lot about how the world works, and especially about how markets operate from a microeconomic perspective. You wouldn't necessarily glean this perspective that I'm advocating for here from watching talking heads on cable news as they debate current events while referring to themselves as economists. But really, I have in mind academic economists agreeing on a core set of principles dating back really centuries, and that core set of principles comprises the economic approach. If you deny those, then you're really going to have to turn in your economist union card, so to speak. Let me just briefly describe two of those big ideas that have united economists through the ages and also kind of undergird what Art and I are trying to communicate in Mere Economics. The first big idea, perhaps the biggest idea in economics, is that social cooperation between humans and even humans that don't know one another, between strangers, is possible. And then it makes the human race better off, that it generates observable patterns. And then it arises without anyone consciously designing it. This is captured famously by Adam Smith's idea of the invisible hand, and I think it's just a crucial insight to grasp because it helps us make sense of both mankind's historical escape from poverty, as well as our present high standards of living. And so, one of the things that economics seeks to do is to provide an intellectually satisfying account of this swift and almost unfathomable transformation of the human condition. You know, the average person in Great Britain today, for example, is at least 30 times richer than his counterpart was in 1800. And that's probably an underestimation once we take into account the vast increase in the quality of goods and services that are available. And so the Nobel Prize-winning economist Angus Deaton refers to this this transformation as the great enrichment. Sorry, he refers to it as the great escape. Another famous economist, Deirdre McCloskey, sometimes refers to it as the great enrichment. A second important idea, again, that you're going to see all economists pay adherence to is the law of demand. And that is that when the price of something rises, people buy the same amount or less, other things equal. And you might think, well, that doesn't necessarily tell me exactly what's going to happen, the same amount or less, but it rules out an important alternative, which is that they might buy more. And this seemingly simple insight actually has some pretty profound implications, because many people believe they've grasped the law of demand when they kind of engaged in a rote memorization about the relationship between price and quantity. But in order to test whether you've really internalized the law of demand, you want to ask whether you understand that, for example, a well-intentioned law that would require people to, say, fasten their infants into a special seat on an airplane. Okay, so this would be something like analogous to a car seat, but for an airplane, as opposed to just holding the infant in their laps. You want to ask people, do you recognize how that law would result in more infant deaths? And it would, okay? It would, so long as driving is more dangerous than flying, and so long as people treat driving as a substitute for flying, which they do. This is actually just downstream of the law of demand, because what you've done here is you've increased the price of flying by requiring people to purchase an additional seat. Law of demand says, hey, people are going to cut back on their purchases. They're going to find a substitute. In this case, it's driving. Which results in an increase in fatalities. And so the law of demand is disarmingly simple, yet it generates many profound insights. And so just kind of wrap up, that was perhaps a long answer, but those two big ideas, this undesigned social cooperation and the law of demand, those really undergird the lion's share of what we write in Mere Economics.
Well, and what's interesting is, you know, I read the book, I recognize a lot of things that to me sound very libertarian, something that, you know, someone in the Austrian or Chicago School of Economics would say. And so when you say it's something that, you know, economists all agree on, the sense that I've sort of gotten from kind of listening to economists on the left and on the right and kind of everywhere in between is that there is fundamental agreement about these principles, but someone who's maybe, you know, Keynesian or someone kind of more, you know, left of center is going to sort of look at those principles and say, well, all that's true, but, right? And so it's like, it becomes a sort of thing where, you know, those who sort of insist on those principles, but they don't want to sort of add on some kind of government intervention or guidance might be called like a market fundamentalist derisively by those on the left. So it sounds like what you're saying is that basically everything here is something that pretty much all economists would agree on, but some economists might nuance it a little bit differently or sort of add on some kind of, you know, governor onto the system. Is that kind of correct? Or?
That's a good question. I mean, I would certainly say that anyone who's really taking fundamental issue with what I was articulating a moment ago, I really just wouldn't consider to be someone who's embraced the economic point of view. And the economic point of view is not about, you know, having a particular political ideology like libertarianism or conservatism or progressivism. It really is about recognizing that first and foremost, people pursue their goals and their objectives as best they can, but that they do so in a world that is full of constraints. And those constraints arise fundamentally from scarcity, that, you know, everything that we want exceeds that which is available to us. And that in turn has important implications for our ability to identify patterns that arise from social interaction. And to me, those kind of three things, so the fact that people take actions, the fact that they also take those actions with respect to one another, which we could call interaction, and that those interactions generate certain outcomes, and those outcomes hinge on or contingent on the institutional context which shape those constraints. To me, those are really the hallmarks of the economic point of view. And you can see that going all the way back to the Spanish scholastics who were disciples of Thomas Aquinas. And the last thing I'd just say on this is that I think a lot of the perception of disagreement on policy issues has to do with the fact that there isn't as much consensus among economists on macroeconomic questions, especially short-run macroeconomics. So that's where we're thinking about things like business cycles and inflation. On the longer-run stuff, which I hinted at with this idea of the social cooperation leading to this great escape or this great enrichment, there actually is a little bit more consensus on the drivers of that. And then, like I alluded in my introduction, there's quite a bit of consensus on how it is that markets operate, and that's a fundamentally microeconomic question.
Right. Maybe other people might find this interesting. I don't know, but I mean, insofar as there's kind of a political tinge to these questions, I mean, it seems that those who are traditionally more conservative or libertarian would kind of want a more hands-off approach. They would sort of recognize these principles, the invisible hand and stuff, and say, okay, so then we probably don't want sort of some central figure trying to kind of manage an economy. Whereas those on the left would maybe be more inclined to say that. And what I've sort of noticed is, you know, some of the data on this, that there's almost no field in academia that's dominated by conservatives, but economics is the most probably conservative field that there is. It's like a little bit left of center. You still have that kind of maybe sort of capture of kind of left-wing academia there, but not nearly to the extent that you might, you know, sort of expect. And in the sense that I've sort of gotten is that, you know, there used to be some kind of Marxist economists, and pretty much all of those people just, you know, dissipated, and then Marxism kind of moved to the English department, and there's just not really that kind of, you know, idea anymore within economics, at least not in professional economics. Is that kind of correct, or am I wrong about that?
No, I think you're thinking about things well. I agree with you that within the mainstream of the economics profession, you're not going to find Marxists. You're not going to find Marxists attending, you know, your mainstream economics conferences, and it has migrated to a whole host of other departments. That's a pretty old development, though. You know, I would trace that all the way back to the end of the 19th century with Baumbaberg's takedown of Marxism, which I think closed that door for a lot of professional economists. To your point about, you know, economists leaning a bit more conservative, I think you're using that word in a pretty big tense sense, but I think that just stems from Thomas Sowell's observation that there are these kind of two visions of the world, and one of those is what he calls the constrained vision, and obviously that is highly compatible with the economic point of view, which emphasizes the fact that yes, people make choices, so there's agency involved in the system, but those choices are always done under the within the context of constraints. And so again, to be an economist is to recognize that fundamental fact about the world. You know, the Nobel laureate economist James Buchanan liked to say that economics puts parameters on people's utopias. And many sort of left-wing or progressivist views, I think, of reality want to downplay the constraints and emphasize the utopian vision.
Well, yeah, and you mentioned the great enrichment earlier. I think Jonah Goldberg calls it something like the miracle, which is this idea that, you know, we've actually seen markets work. We've seen what happens when you free up markets. And so maybe it's just at this point a little bit difficult to argue in good faith, if you really know anything about history and economics, that a heavy-handed centralized approach really works. Maybe you can't really argue with the evidence. Is that kind of why that there might maybe has been a shift?
Yeah, I think if by works you mean you know, generates the greatest amount of wealth for mankind, rising standards of living on a per capita basis, then yes, absolutely. And so many of the critics of markets, you know, shift the goalposts, I think, a little bit and say, okay, well, it does generate the most material prosperity, but what about X, Y, or Z? You know, does it, you know, provide for man's deepest spiritual needs or something like this? And I mean, you know, I would be the first in line to say, no, it doesn't. That's because I'm a Christian and I don't think that, you know, political or economic freedom is the ultimate solution to mankind's fundamental problems.
Okay, cool. Well, so just to kind of refocus on the book just a little bit. So, I mean, I'm not like a numbers guy. And so, which is what I think most people might assume you have to be in order to study economics, even maybe an introductory textbook like yours. But you know, I love learning about like the fundamental principles of economics. You know, if you start, you know, giving me numbers and charts, I'm going to have a hard time following maybe. But these sort of fundamental principles that you're talking about, they're really just principles about acting intelligently in the world, making choices, you know, acknowledging that there are limits that you, when you choose X, you might not be able to choose Y, and there are trade-offs and things like that.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I want to say to listeners at the outset, you know, if you're not a numbers nerd, you'll still get a lot of wisdom from this book that's going to help you to, I think, better understand the world around you through these kind of basic lessons of mere economics. And so I just want to say I've really enjoyed it, and I plan on using it as part of my family's homeschooling curriculum next year. So I want to thank you for writing this book. It's very easy to follow and lays out these principles and you know, really kind of readable, helpful ways.
Oh, well, thank you for those very kind words. I'm certainly hopeful that the homeschoolers and private schoolers as well find the book to be valuable. I certainly also agree with your point about the fundamental principles of economics. I think it's a big mistake to conflate economics with being a numbers guy or to conflate it with statistics, because economics is really a framework. It's a way of thinking about the world with the primary phenomenon it's trying to explain being that widespread social cooperation that takes place all around us every day. And so each of us is already familiar with the phenomena that economics examines. Really, so long as we're not talking about someone who's like truly isolated, living the life of a hermit, you know, what economists refer to as being autarkic. And so I think that would cover just about anybody listening to the podcast. They have an internet connection. And so there certainly is that familiarity that is already there. What economics is trying to do is just bring a logic or an organizing set of principles to make better and deeper sense of that, of those phenomena with which we already have daily contact.
Well, yeah, and I think, you know, economics is a large degree about trade, but it seems to me even if you were living on a, you know, deserted island by yourself, you're still going to have to think in terms of trade-offs, in terms of your limitations and you know, choosing, you know, trying to make the best decision you can based on what your options are. So I think there's principles there that work even if you happen to be completely alone.
Yeah, certainly. Yeah, I don't want to deny the fact that we can learn a lot from the so-called Robinson Crusoe constructs that many economists start with, you know. I think that's it can be a helpful starting point for economics. I just think that like where the action is, no pun intended, is thinking about interaction between people and how it is that despite the fact that people may have conflicting goals, despite the fact those conflicting goals exist in a world of scarce resources, they nonetheless can cooperate to mutual gain. And I think that's where the real payoff in learning economics resides.
Great. Thank you. So, I mean, I want people to buy the book, so I don't want to give away everything that's in it. Give them the impression that, you know, they pretty much have gotten the book if they've listened to this interview. So I think what I might do is I maybe won't give away what's in each of the chapters, but maybe focus a little bit more on kind of the early chapters where you're, I think, maybe laying the groundwork a little bit more for what's going to be developed later. And so you write in the introduction about the miracle of a simple cheeseburger that's brought to a patron of a bar. So this is kind of the miraculous pencil illustration from Leonard Reed, but it's the miraculous cheeseburger, which does sound more miraculous, I think, to me. And so the miraculous part is that, you know, all the hands that had a part in its production, even though they didn't have the patron or perhaps even the end product of the cheeseburger in mind. And so you write, did the cattle ranchers, wheat farmers, potato growers, truck drivers, meat packers, app developers, and servers wake up early or go to bed late because they were thinking about feeding you specifically? No, they have families to feed, kids to raise, churches to support, and hobbies to pursue. They have their own interests. And then you quote Adam Smith, who said, "It's not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interests. We address ourselves not to their humanity, but to their self-love, and never talk to them of our own necessities, but of their advantages," end quote. So from a Christian perspective that maybe looks out for the interests of others, this system that seems to be built on self-interest, even if it works really well, even if it actually in practice does feed, house, and clothe the least of these, some might say, well, this sounds immoral. Just because it does all these good things, if the motive or intention is not self-giving love or something, doesn't that make it immoral or seedy or in some ways, you know, kind of gross? You know, shouldn't our motives be pure and altruistic if we can even really call the end result good?
Yeah, that's a really good and important question. I think it's a question that has animated the thought of political economists and social philosophers for a couple of centuries. And so I really think the impulse behind the question is great. But my own view is that this apparent tension is an illusion. And I think the tension arises from thinking that what economists usually mean when they use the term self-interest is what the average person, or a virtue ethicist for that matter, if you want to be really precise, what that sort of person means by selfishness. And self-interest and selfishness are not the same thing. For economists, self-interest refers to the fact that each of us desires more command over resources in order to satisfy a greater number of our goals. And it also implies that those goals are our own. You know, each individual person chooses their ends or their objectives. They're not chosen for them. And they seek to be effective rather than ineffective in reaching those goals. Now, this business about more command over scarce resources that I mentioned a moment ago, that might still sound like selfishness, or like you were saying, might sound like there's something a little bit nefarious or less than ethically virtuous about it, but it doesn't have to be. Selfishness refers to the content of my goals. So do I place value at all on the welfare of other people? And the less that I do of that, we would say the more selfish that I am. But the fact that I desire greater control over scarce resources could simply be because my goal is to bless others somehow, to lift them up, to improve their situation, or to be philanthropic or something along those lines. Now, Mother Teresa is every bit as self-interested as the worst scoundrel, the most narcissistic, selfish scoundrel that you can envision. But the content of their ends clearly differed dramatically. You know, she sought control over transportation. That's a scarce resources are involved there in order to travel to India. And once there, she sought control over other scarce resources to provide food and shelter and education to the orphans that she was caring for. If someone had volunteered their labor to her or donated a building to her cause, she would say yes. Not because she's selfish, but in fact, because she was not particularly selfish. If someone had offered her a donation of fresh bread or moldy bread, say they'd given her a choice, I'll give you fresh bread for the orphans or moldy bread, she would have picked the fresh bread. Not because she's self-centered, but again, because her interests include this desire to care for those that were entrusted to her. I'll say this as well, and I say this with all reverence, but you know, even Jesus, our Savior, was self-interested. And by that, I mean that he's pursuing his mission of redeeming a people for himself while he's on earth and as effectively as he can, which thankfully for us, in this case, means with utter perfection. And he's doing it with utter resolve. And unlike us, he's not making any errors in the decisions that he's making.
Jesus is the rational actor that economists wish that we all were.
Well, I mean, I would say that we all are. It's just that one of the differences between our actions and Jesus's is that our actions do not always achieve our goals and our ends. So that's one difference. So we make errors, we make mistakes. And then another difference is that our goals and motives are corrupted by sin. Right. So I would say that we are rational as Jesus was in the economist sense, but there are some important differences about our actions. Just say one other thing about this that I think is important, which is that really the fundamental insight of economics, going back to this point about social cooperation, is, you know, if everybody is seeking greater control over scarce resources, then we are going to want some way of translating that universal self-interest-seeking behavior into widespread social gain, and rather than widespread misery or violent conflict in society. And I think the most important thing that economics discovered for us is that the rules of the game, the institutional framework, can do kind of one of two things. I mean, it's a spectrum, but you can think about on either extreme of that spectrum, the rules of the game either funneling self-interest in what we would call positive sum directions, that is, our interactions generate more wealth, or those rules of the game can channel it toward zero or even negative sum outcomes. And just briefly, the way that you can get those kind of two alternative outcomes is that, you know, if people's private property rights are strong, that means that they can only get what they want by offering others what they in turn want. And both sides gain. That's what we mean when we say positive sum. And when property rights are weaker, perhaps then it actually pays more to raid rather than to trade. Or perhaps the government in your society is handing out special favors. It may pay more to seek what we want through that avenue, through what economists call rent seeking, although that's a bit of a misnomer. But essentially what that amounts to is getting the government to slice the pie differently rather than seeking to grow the pie overall.
Well, and so, I mean, it sounds like what you're describing is, I mean, people talk about sometimes like that you have two options. You can either be selfish or you can be altruistic, and that's right. And the insight of what happens when you create like a free society or a free market is that people's own self-interest is wrapped up in what they can produce for others. And so what's, you know, we think of capitalism as selfishness, but it is kind of a, what's really fascinating about this was Adam Smith's observation, is that you can take self-interest and actually, whatever the opposite of weaponizing is, you can use it and make something good out of it, where actually that self-interest then helps others. Whereas in a zero sum, kind of a non-free market approach, you can only really take from others. You can't actually produce something that will be beneficial to yourself and to others. And so I think there's something really kind of fascinating about that process, that that self-interest, instead of being something that is destructive, that can actually be constructive. Right.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And I mean, look, there are only a few different ways in order for a human being to get what that human being wants. And these are, you know, these are logically exhaustive ways, right? You can either make it yourself. We refer to that as autarky or self-sufficiency. And if we did that for everything that we want to consume, we'd be extremely poor. We would not consume very much if we all lived as isolated hermits. Or you can depend on being the recipient of gifts. Okay, well, once again, think about how impoverished your life would be if everything that you consumed, you had to rely on someone else in society who's also relying on receiving gifts, giving you as a gift, okay? Or you can seize it. You can engage in raiding behavior as opposed to trading. And finally, you can engage in this specialization and then subsequent trade. What's interesting about those four, I think, logically exhaustive means of acquiring what you want is that each of them has systematic properties associated with them. And this is part of what I was getting at when I said, you know, you'd have to kind of turn in your economist card if you denied that these systematic properties were in operation. But only one of those three, if you were to sort of operationalize it across all of society, if you were to kind of, you know, use the Kantian notion of the imperative, imagine that every person is seeking what they want via these means, well, only one of those actually results in widespread and high living standards for people. And it's that final option, specialization and trade.
Yeah, I was thinking of the dichotomy that you gave sort of four ways, but Franz Oppenheimer, the sociologist, who said that there were two means of acquiring wealth: the economic means, which is work and trade, and then the political means, which is stealing.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think, you know, I'm certainly familiar with Oppenheimer's distinction. I think he would categorize those first two that I mentioned as being part of the economic means, namely that you're not, you know, using force or the threat of force to acquire what you want when you produce something yourself or when you, you know, voluntarily accept a gift from someone. But yeah, to go to your point, you know, you cannot operationalize the political means in a widespread fashion across society and actually expect that society not just to have high standards of living, but even to persist over time.
Yeah, well, and so we talked a little bit about kind of motive versus results. And, you know, some people question whether or not a market motive can be good. And sometimes what they sort of put in place of that is, okay, well, let's just steal money and redistribute it. that would be maybe better somehow or more moral somehow. But the, you know, thinking in terms of kind of motive versus result, you know, sometimes this idea of governments confiscating wealth from the rich and distributing it to the poor can be seen as the most righteous because it intends to help the poor as a primary motive, setting aside the fact that it's violence. That motive is there, so maybe that makes it good, right? But you argue that this approach creates unintended consequences, which can be disastrous. So there's this quote I wrote down from your book: "Sincerity is overrated, results are underrated, and big talk about motives is cheap." Big talk about good motives is cheap. Why does starting with the assumption that the only way to help the poor is to put government in charge of the economy actually harm the poor compared to a free economy?
Yeah, it's another great question. So the moral philosopher James Otteson, who's at the University of Notre Dame, also a very good economist, I should add, he routinely makes the point that before asking what we can do for the poor, we should ask what we should stop doing to the poor. So those little words make a big difference, for versus to. Because so much of our public policy has the consequence, either intended or unintended, of stifling the very thing that the poor need in order to better themselves, which is to pursue an honest living. And so if we want to help the poor, we can at least begin. We can begin by doing things like removing occupational licensure, which requires that a person get costly permission from the government before they can serve their fellow man, before they can engage in that fourth means of acquiring what they want, trade. And so when you raise the cost of social cooperation, as occupational licensure does, you get less social cooperation. Less social cooperation translates to less wealth, which is just a shorthand for the things that we value. We could abolish the minimum wage, which makes it more costly to take a chance on hiring that low-skilled guy who has scary-looking tattoos and even a scarier-looking criminal record, perhaps. We could abolish rent control, which ironically makes housing less accessible in urban settings by reducing the rate of return that entrepreneurs can get by investing in low-income housing. And I should add, too, that you know, even more straightforward attempts to help the poor, like a simple transfer payment that you observe under the welfare state, those also often backfire. So I'll refer to the Nobel laureate economist James Buchanan again. He coined this helpful term, the Samaritan's dilemma, which of course he's referring to the parable that Jesus tells in Luke 10 to describe how attempts at helping can hurt the intended recipients of aid. So in a nutshell, I think this logic is really commonsensical. When you try to help someone to be a good Samaritan, you can undermine that person's incentives to engage in self-improvement. You can even incentivize them to take steps that make them eligible for additional aid in the future. And those steps can be completely at odds with what the recipient would do to become someone who does not need a handout. So you can be working at cross purposes with your stated goal, in other words. I think the most extreme example of that occurs in places like India, where sometimes you will actually observe beggars who have mutilated themselves or worse, their children, to increase the sympathy of almsgivers. It's, you know, it's grotesque and it's a heinous evil, whether you're talking about self-mutilation or especially of a child. Okay. But this Samaritan's dilemma is a problem for both private and public parties. I don't want to suggest that this is kind of the unique purview of governmental attempts to help. But what I do think is true is that there are compelling reasons to think that government programs face steeper knowledge and incentive problems that basically reduce their odds of successfully overcoming the Samaritan's dilemma. Private parties like nonprofits, they have more intimate knowledge of those whom they're trying to help. And they have, I think, better incentives to monitor recipients' behavior in order to keep donors happy. So, you know, when an economist raises objections to governmental programs to help the poor, such as a transfer payment, like we're talking about, that isn't because the economist is a cold-hearted sociopath. Okay, at least that's not usually the case. It's really because it's rooted in a what we call sometimes in economics a comparative institutional analysis. And that's just a cold, I don't mean cold as in like heartless, I just mean, you know, a very calculating, rational look at those different systematic properties between the two different means of trying to achieve this goal. And that oftentimes concludes that private organizations are typically superior for achieving this noble goal of helping the poor than our public ones.
Yeah, as you were talking about these kind of unintended consequences, I thought of an example I'd read recently in preparation for an interview with Jane Claire Tyner from End It for Good, which is a nonprofit that focuses on kind of trying to end the drug war. But their founder had written a book talking about kind of her change of perspective on the drug war. And an example she sort of gave of those kinds of unintended consequences was when she was a kid, she talked about this ministry newsletter that her family used to get. And one of the issues that came out was asking for funds to try to release people from slavery in some, you know, far-flung country where they were still practicing slavery and maybe still are. And so they collected all this money and it was this kind of really well-intended thing. And, you know, they were real excited. They were able to, you know, buy some people, redeem some people from slavery. And then once the slave market realized that there were these people out here spending all this Western money on redeeming slaves, they just started kidnapping more people and turning them into slaves. And so then, you know, the nonprofit, to their credit, sort of came back later and said, okay, well, we're not going to do these slave buybacks anymore because it's the unintended consequences are actually worse than than what would happen if we did nothing, right? And so the good intention ended up being something that was actually really destructive. And I think that's something we have to keep in mind when we talk about, you know, well, the government should do this or the state should do that, or this policy, we should enact this policy, is that, you know, we could create these unintended consequences. And the downside of, you know, I'm sure it was very difficult for that nonprofit to make that admission that they'd made a mistake. But I've never heard of a government program going away because there was, you know, data that it was just a bad idea. That is something to think about.
Yeah, it's a great point. If I'm thinking of the same case that you are, yeah, there was this famous instance in, I think it was the 1980s with Christian Solidarity International buying Christian Sudanese women who had were being pressed into slavery with the intent of, you know, offering them their freedom. But I think you make a really salient point, which is that when you're situated in the context of markets, in this case, you have to satisfy donors, you have feedback that comes to bear on you, and you have an incentive to listen to that feedback. And that's really at the heart of what we mean by comparative institutional analysis. Does a government bureau have the same incentive? No. In fact, you know, if a government bureau were to eliminate the problem that they were tasked with eliminating, what does that mean? It means all those bureaucrats are out of a job and their incomes fall. And so I don't want to suggest that there's no feedback at all, right? It's just that the nature of the feedback is different. And so I think it was Milton Friedman who observed that, you know, there are many different invisible hands. Okay, so there's the invisible hand of the market. And it provides feedback to do certain things. And then there's the invisible hand that tends to govern, say, the operation of bureaucracies, provides a different set of feedback, which in turn results in different behaviors.
Yeah, well, and politicians in particular have a kind of a unique situation, because if, you know, 70% of their constituents don't like something, but 30% of their constituents really want it because they benefit in some way through jobs or money or handouts or whatever. But the 70% don't care that much about it. It's just not really on their radar that much. But that 30% may, you know, would really be upset if their politician went against it. They may do something that's unpopular just because they don't want to risk a vote. And so there are definitely different incentives there. So, you know, sometimes you see, you know, folks on the left lamenting the fact that we have to make a living. This was something I was thinking about a little bit as I was reading your book, because you see it all the time, this idea that, you know, if human beings are valuable and have dignity, then nobody should ever have to worry about making a living. You know, that should just be kind of guaranteed to them. And that sounds, you know, really, you know, kind of high, you know, high values or whatever. But basically, you know, they seem to be comparing life today within an imaginary perfect society as opposed to a state of nature. And so, you know, it would be great if we lived in a world where nobody had to work to be taken care of and they just sort of had it, but that's not really the world we live in. And so, and it's because of scarcity, right? Scarcity imposes a cost for living that's unavoidable. So can you elaborate on that just a little bit? Something that you write about in the book.
Sure. I think it's critical to begin by grasping what economists mean by scarcity. If there's no scarcity, there's no economics. Here's a few ways to think about what it means. Something is scarce if the desire for it exceeds what's freely available in nature. Something is scarce if you have to sacrifice something else to get it. That could be something like your time, for example. Something is scarce if what everybody wants exceeds all that there is. Now, scarcity implies that we have to make choices. We have to choose when and where to consume the apple that we have, when and where to wear that particular pair of shoes, how hard to drive our car, since that will cause it to wear out more or less quickly, and so on. And every choice comes with a cost, something that we necessarily give up. So when I decide to eat the apple with my 11:30 a.m. lunch, I can't then also use it in the pie that I want to bake this afternoon. So scarcity implies cost. Scarcity also implies that competition is omnipresent. And competition is one of those words that has kind of a negative valence associated with it, but it needn't, okay? All that it means is that people are seeking, or they're striving to meet some criteria, whatever criteria is used in the social system in question, to become the owner of a scarce resource. And so you can think about alternative economic systems as being different means of coping with the scarcity that each human being, since the beginning of time, has confronted. Now, this might sound obvious, but has really important implications. The first of which is that something like an economic system, like capitalism, does not create competition. Okay, in fact, capitalism loosens the natural constraints that scarcity imposes on us by allowing us to produce more. And socialism, what it does, to take kind of the opposite end of the economic system spectrum, it exacerbates our already naturally poor condition, okay? And so what differs from economic system to economic system is not the presence or absence of competition, which is how it's sometimes framed, but rather it's what differs is the way that the competition, which is necessarily there, how it manifests. Okay, so under capitalism, it manifests peacefully and productively through specialization. And so that's the productive part, and then through exchange, which is both peaceful and productive. Now, you had this point about the certain people lamenting that we have to make a living. And I think I've oftentimes heard that leveled as a critique of capitalism, that capitalism forces us to have to work in order to live, as if that would not be the case under some other social arrangement. Okay, but I like Thomas Sowell on this very point. He has this great section at the beginning of his classic book, Mere Economics, where he is speaking about middle-class Americans and someone is kind of lamenting their fate, lamenting that it's difficult for them to make ends meet. And he says this, he says, quote, "It is not something as man-made as a budget which constrains them," them being middle-class Americans. Back to Sowell, he says, "Reality constrains them. There has never been enough to satisfy everyone completely. That is the real constraint. That is what scarcity means." That's the end of the quote. So people would still have to make a living under whatever economic or social arrangement that you can observe, either in the historical record or that you can conceive of in your imagination. You know, whether we're talking about primitive tribal arrangements or whether you're thinking about industrialized socialism, or in a commune, or in a pure isolated autarky, you know, as we mentioned earlier, because nature does not yield its bounty willingly, and least of all after the curse that's on mankind that we know about from Genesis 3. So, you know, it's not your boss, it's not your employer, it's not the system, it's not the man that's forcing you to have to make a living, as if the alternative is that you wouldn't have to under some other social arrangement. It's just reality itself. And so that turns our attention, you know, as scholars, as analysts, to the question, well, what social system or what economic system allows us to produce the most with the least as we seek to make a living? Okay. And for reasons that we've kind of hinted at, but that we might want to explore a bit more, the answer is basically that it's private property in the means of production. It allows us to specialize, it allows us to exchange, and that process generates the most with the least.
Yeah. I mean, you know, I think the point that creating a command economy doesn't make goods less scarce, right? It's they're still just as scarce. In fact, they can be more so. Because government central planners aren't good at producing things. Have you seen this stat about private gardens in the Soviet Union?
Are you familiar with
the data point? I have some of the numbers in front of me, but I don't remember the exact proportion of private plots versus publicly owned plots. But basically, agriculture was controlled by the state. But they did allow farmers like these kind of small private plots that they were allowed to sort of tend and that they could sell from that market, you know, to take that to market and benefit from that. And I think that the stat that I pulled up was in 1966, the private sector in Soviet Union contributed, 40% of the meat, 39% of the milk, and 66% of the eggs that were produced in the Soviet Union. And that those are these small private plots. And so they were significantly more productive than these sort of command economy controlled, plots were. So ultimately it becomes one of those things that, as much as it sounds nice, you know, let's create this kind of utopia where nobody has to work, or, even communists wouldn't say that, but it sounds nice, but it just doesn't actually work. That the best way to actually deal with scarcity is through production, through markets, right?
That's exactly right. And I think that's a great segue to talk a little bit more about how exactly exchange does that, because that can seem a little bit abstract when you just put it that way.
Right. We go back to the cheeseburger, right?
Yeah.
So we talked about the cheeseburger. If I want to produce a cheeseburger myself, I have to grow the wheat, I have to milk the cow, I have to produce the cheese, I've got to butcher the cow, I have to go maybe collect the sesame seeds if I want a sesame seed bun. So what is how does exchange help me in that situation where I'm having to deal with scarcity? I only have so much time. Do I really want to spend days and days and days just to produce one cheeseburger for myself?
Yeah, I mean, the fact that exchange lowers our costs of getting the things we want, to use that phrase that I've kind of been referencing, that is not, I don't think, immediately obvious, but it is very profound. Okay. And here's kind of the basic underlying dynamic for why we see this. Okay. When I have the possibility to exchange, it means I don't have to produce everything I want to consume. Okay. So I'm not this autarkic hermit. And not having to produce everything I want to consume means I can specialize in producing what I'm relatively best at. I'll produce for the market instead of only for my personal consumption. Or in other words, most of what I produce in a commercial society, and I'm using I here just be a stand-in for any hypothetical worker, I'm not going to consume. I'm going to trade it for money, which in turn I use to buy the wide variety of goods and services that I do want. So to speak specifically about myself for a moment, I currently specialize in producing economics lectures, which I sell to Grove City College, who in turn provides me with income that I use to provide for the things that I want and to provide for my family. The word or the term that often gets thrown around by economists in this context oftentimes is comparative advantage. To explain why this process is so amazing, let me give you just an example rather than trying to abstractly communicate it. Imagine that there's a brain surgeon who really likes to garden. And maybe he's got a green thumb, so he's really good at it. And maybe he's also got a teenage neighbor who's not very good at gardening, but he's downright terrible at sawing your head open and fixing your brain. Okay, you don't want him doing that. And so in this very simple example, we would say that the teenage neighbor has a comparative advantage in gardening because he doesn't sacrifice much of value when he gardens. But by contrast, our brain surgeon would. Okay, he would sacrifice time conducting perhaps life-saving brain surgeries. And so when we have each of these people in our example specialize in their comparative advantage, we get more beautiful gardens and more brain surgeries than if they did both of these things themselves, okay? And notice that other members of this society are better off too because they benefit from there being more beautiful flowers in society and especially from there being more life-saving brain surgeries available. Okay, now that is kind of the magic of specialization, but let's tie that back to exchange. Us getting that increase in output, okay, so more gardens and more brain surgeries, that hinges entirely on exchange, okay? And our ability to exchange hinges on there being a robust system of private property rights. You cannot exchange that which you do not own or that which you do not control. And so the philosopher David Hume he has this kind of three-part phrase. He refers to property, contract, and consent. Okay, as sort of the institutional prerequisites that undergird our ability to transfer property. Seeing the connection between exchange and this greater output is pretty straightforward. If I'm forbidden to exchange what I want to consume, then I have to produce everything myself. Okay, and I think there's a really great illustration of how poor we would be under this self-sufficiency in this book by a fellow named Thomas Thwaites. He's written a book called The Toaster Project. And in it, Thwaites very humorously chronicles his attempt to build a toaster all by himself without exchanging for anything. So he's not going to engage in this social cooperation that I keep referring to. And to cut to the chase, you know, it takes him 9 months of hard labor to make a simple toaster. He does kind of cheat along the way. He does make some exchanges. And at the end of the day, he comes up with this really crummy looking cheap appliance that shorts out the moment that he plugs it in, and then it melts down before he can use it to toast a single slice of bread. And we're not even talking about a super fancy toaster that can do your homework for you or something like that. Okay, we're talking about, you know, the cheapest cheapo model that you could, you know, run to Walmart right now and pick up. Okay. And he could not get even there by himself. And so I think that's a little slice, no pun intended, of what our lives would look like if we were all isolated and couldn't engage in exchange.
So it's kind of amazing to me to think that, you know, we can actually like help provide a living for the vast majority of our neighbors just by leaving them alone and letting them kind of make their own living. And you know that becomes way more efficient. It means that other people can thrive without having to rely on me all the time. So I don't necessarily have to feel guilty if I buy a burrito at Chipotle instead of, you know, selling my house and giving the money to the poor. And that feels, I mean, really liberating to me, that I don't have to carry the world on my shoulders or come up with some policy to save it. But let's say I agree with everything you said so far about how open markets can make the world a better, more prosperous place. Well, isn't prosperity bad for the soul? Doesn't suffering bring us closer to God? Shouldn't Christians be trying to build a world on a more modest prosperity that still has plenty of good old-fashioned suffering, you know, somewhere between the devastation of the Great War and the, you know, happy-go-lucky times of Leave It to Beaver, maybe. Maybe tariffs would help. We could bring in tariffs. That might solve it, bring us back there. Should we feel guilty about prosperity? Isn't that bad for us?
Oh man, that's certainly a colorful way of framing the issue. And I think once again, you're hitting at a kind of a perennial sort of question that economists and social philosophers have grappled with. I'll give you my response to it. I'm certainly not Pollyannish about modernity. Okay, and I don't want to deny the spiritual problems that are associated with this great enrichment or this great escape, or what Ed Phelps, another Nobel laureate economist, refers to as mass flourishing. Okay, so there he's referring just to our material conditions. I mean, it's certainly possible for even Christians to put our trust in wealth in the same way that, or a similar fashion at least, to the way that people in the psalmist day might have been tempted to put their hope in the horse and the chariot. And I think there's several points to make about your broader question about, you know, is suffering or deprivation or impoverishment better for the soul? And therefore, ought we to condemn our current high standards of living, you know, on the basis of that evaluation? And so I think the first thing I would say about this is that our situation is, in some sense, at least at the individual level, it is optional. Okay, it really is. You could forsake material abundance if you wanted to. you could forsake it. And that does not contradict the notion of self-interest either, because it just means that you have a different goal. You know, your goal is asceticism or something, and you're going to pursue that as best as you can. You know, and so what would this look like in practice? Well, I mean, the next time you step on a rusty nail, you could forego the Neosporin and the tetanus shot, okay? You could suggest to your wife that while she's in labor, she forego the epidural. although that might be an even quicker way to come face to face with your maker than stepping on the rusty nail, now that I think about it. But you know, the point is that our ancestors' lives of sickness and want, which is really what characterized, you know, 99% of human beings for 99% of history, that situation is within our grasp. Which means that our situation is asymmetrical in important respects to theirs, because no amount of wishing or projection could have bestowed on them the fabulous riches that we enjoy. But we can choose to live like our peasant forefathers if we wanted to. Okay, so that's the first thing I would say. And then, I mean, there's other things I would say too. Like, it's important to grasp that prosperity also frees us from the crushing hours of labor that we used to work just to quote unquote make a living, you know, just to achieve the minimal subsistence or a little bit above it that was necessary to kind of keep body and soul together in this vale of tears. So, for example, you know, before the Industrial Revolution, the average German worker, he worked something like 3,000 hours a year. And by now, we've almost halved that figure, all while per person output has exploded dramatically. And so those hard-won leisure hours that we've kind of wrestled from nature's inherently unbounteous estate, those things could be applied to spiritual pursuits. They could be applied to intellectual pursuits. They could be used to spend time with family or to read or to pray or to study scripture or what have you. And I'm not saying that as a positive fact that people are observed to be, you know, allocating all this additional leisure in that way. Although I would say that they certainly are allocating much of it that way, because you know, your average medieval peasant is illiterate. They're certainly not engaging in Bible study like we are. Okay, and so this leisure time, some of which is, you know, used wisely by us, and other proportion of it is not. Nonetheless, it is a consequence of rising prosperity. Okay, kind of a third thing that occurs to me is that, you know, what you might be suggesting, I realize you're suggesting this, I think as devil's advocate, but is that artificially suppressing the rate of growth via some sort of policy, it does not strike me as being consistent with the marching orders that were given to mankind in Genesis 1, okay? To take dominion over the earth, to fill it, to subdue it, and so on. Because a rising and even high standard of living is really necessary to support rising population growth. And a large world population is, in my view, part and parcel of that command. Okay, so when in our English translations it talks about filling the earth, in the Septuagint, the Hebrew language that's used there really carries the connotation of filling the earth till it's overflowing, so that there's this teeming and abundance of life. And in order to have that, you do need to have the vast amount of production, the mass production that in turn translates to that mass flourishing. Okay, if you want to have mass consumption, which you do need in order to have a large and growing population, you need to have mass production. Okay. And then I guess there's one other thing that occurs to me as well, which is that there really are spiritual temptations that arise from destitution and impoverishment. Also, just like there can be spiritual temptations that arise from being wealthy. So it's not at all clear to me that policymakers could somehow hit, you know, the spiritual golden mean of material prosperity by tinkering with different policy tools or by pulling different policy levers, especially once you consider that golden mean is probably different from person to person. And that is part of our spiritual maturation in this world, right? Is to exercise our judgment over our property in ways that includes charity and in ways that balances the income that we earn against the leisure time that we enjoy and so on, okay? As for your comment about tariffs, I mean, there's a lot there, but maybe I would just refer our colleagues to our earlier discussion about exchange. And, you know, you could start with the fact that tariffs, you know, hamper our ability to engage in that and engage in that exchange.
No, I like what you brought up from Genesis 1. I mean, it seems to me that markets become this way where humans can kind of steward the earth, as Genesis 1 says, but without dominating other humans through violence. And it's kind of ironic to me that those who are opposed to markets are suggesting that it would be more righteous to increase violence. You know, maybe they start at Genesis 1 and don't go to Genesis 6, where they find out what happens there. But so maybe one last question, because we're a little over an hour now. You quote Wendell Berry, who, for those who don't know who Wendell Berry is, he's kind of like the Henry David Thoreau of Christians who shop at Whole Foods. But you quote Wendell Berry's dictum that rats and roaches live by the law of supply and demand, whereas human beings have the privilege to live by the laws of justice and mercy. And that sounds like pretty spiritual advice. So, but you take issue with it. So why is that?
Yeah. Well. First off, let me just say that, you know, Wendell Berry is definitely a brilliant man, and it would be fantastic if I could write with a fraction of his ability at some point in my life. That would be amazing. But I think that this statement of his does commit a pretty big category error. Okay, so the laws of economics, of which the laws of supply and demand are the crowning jewel, in my opinion. They occupy the same ontological status as the laws of physics. It's not a popular thing to say, but I believe it's true. And at the same time, we do use a different epistemological procedure in each discipline to discover what those laws are. But in other words, the import of saying that, I think, is that the laws of supply and demand, they're not the sort of things that we can simply opt out of in favor of some more romanticized conception of organizing social life, okay? We can't get all the bounteous things that a market economy provides without having the market economy, okay? Now, thankfully, the laws of supply and demand are not in conflict with the laws of justice and mercy. And that's not surprising to me as a Christian, since I think that both moral and economic laws originate in the mind of a divine lawgiver, okay? There are these different rules that I've been mentioning that human beings can live under, they can organize their social interactions under. And one of those possible rules is a private property rule where resource claims change possession only on the basis of willing acceptance made in response to buyer's offers. Okay. And supply and demand describes that process. But there are other means too or other rules under which human beings can live, and those rules can also determine who gets what. And violence is one of those ways, and historically it has been a fairly dominant way of deciding who gets what. Now, the reason I mentioned violence in response to this question is because that's precisely how it is that rats and roaches tend to interact with one another. So Adam Smith famously observed that, he said something like, I'm paraphrasing here, but no one has ever seen a dog exchange a bone with another dog. All right. So we do not observe dogs engaging in specialization and exchange. And if that's true of man's best friend, I think it's probably also true of these lower creatures like rats and rodents that rats and roaches that are pests. And so as a professor, mentor, friend of mine, Pete Betke likes to say, mankind possesses both Adam Smithian propensities to truck, barter, and trade. That's a phrase from Smith, and that's where supply and demand comes in. But they also possess these Hobbesian, referring to Thomas Hobbes, these Thomas Hobbesian propensities to rape, pillage, and plunder, although that's another phrase from Smith, okay? And that latter way of interacting is frankly how rats and roaches primarily interact. Which set of propensities dominates for human beings is by and large a function of the rules of the game under which they live and which tend to reward one or other of those sets of activities. And so I think that, you know, with all due respect, I think that Barry's statement here is just backwards because it is human beings who are at least capable of interacting with one another on peaceful, mutually beneficial, positive-sum terms to which supply and demand reasoning applies. And so when we eliminate supply and demand as the means for determining who gets what, then we're actually taking a big step in the direction of rats and roaches. Because these do not exchange with one another in the sense that humans do. By and large, animals treat one another purely as means. But in markets, if I want something from you, as I said at the beginning, you know, I first have to discover how I can serve your ends, your desires, your goals to get it. And that, I think, makes us fundamentally and radically different from animals. And it's supply and demand that describes that process.
I've been talking with Dr. Caleb S. Fuller. Thanks for taking time to talk with us, Caleb. I really appreciate it. Loved your book. Where can folks find you and where can they find Mere Economics?
Well, thank you, Cody. It's been a delight speaking with you this morning. You can find more of my writing at my personal website, which is calebsfuller.com. And you can find Mere Economics, my most recent book, on Amazon or pretty much anywhere else in the division of labor where booksellers are found.
And I saw there's a paperback and a Kindle. Do you think you guys may have an audiobook out at some point?
I hope so. I think that may be in the works.
Cool. Yeah, I hope so too. I'd like to see become easier for everybody to get a hold of it. So, okay. Well, thank you again, Dr. Fuller, and I appreciate your time. Looking forward to talking to you when your next book comes out.
Well, thank you very much, Cody, and hope you have a great day.
You too.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Libertarian Christian Podcast. If you liked today's episode, we encourage you to rate us on Apple Podcasts to help expand our audience. If you want to reach out to us, email us at podcast@libertarianchristians.com. You can also reach us at LCI Official on Twitter. And of course, we are on Facebook and have an active group. You are welcome to join. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time.
The Libertarian Christian Podcast is a project of the Libertarian Christian Institute, a registered 501c3 nonprofit. If you'd like to find out more about LCI, visit us on the web at libertarianchristians.com. The voiceovers are by Matt Bellis and Catherine Williams. As of episode 115, our audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.
Hello, everyone. It's Doug from the Libertarian Christian Podcast. You might notice already that this recording sounds quite a bit different from usual. In fact, it probably sounds pretty crappy. Well, I'm doing this to show you something pretty amazing. As you might know, the guys over at Podsworth Media have been producing my show for several years, quite a while, hundreds of episodes. And now they have a brand new online app for taking rough recordings like this one and making them sound a whole lot cleaner and a lot more listenable in just a few easy clicks. So here are some of the core features. They remove background noise. It reduces plosives, which is really handy for me because I often forget to put my pop filter on before I do a YouTube video. Because pop filters look terrible when you're on camera. It fixes clipping. It removes clicks and pops. It evenly levels dialogue so that you don't have somebody talking really quietly. And then somebody talking really loud because they're too close to the mic or too far away from the mic. How do you use it? It's easy. You go to podsworth.com, you click get started, and because you're a listener to one of the Libertarian Christian Institute's podcasts, you can get 50% off your first order by entering the promo code LCI50. That's LCI50. And you will get 50% off your first order. If you are doing anything like a podcast, a video, a sermon, an audiobook, anything that's spoken word, you want to use podsworth.com and clean up your audio to be even more professional and polished.